Chapter 13. The Qing was passive, but the resolution more than adequate for his purposes. He exited his standing body, rose into the air, and drifted over the treetops, gaining speed and altitude. Sometimes it was good not to take the Cessna, or one of the other machines, just to become a disembodied witness with a viewpoint assembled from distributed public eyes. The scene was rendered with exacting thoroughness down to the last leaf, the last hoof print, or elephant footprint in the dust. Any uncertainty in the image flow was seamlessly interpolated long before his brain had to fill in any gaps. He found the herd soon enough. Whatever status Matilda might have lost among the other females when she was startled by Eunice's figment had been regained over the ensuing weeks. Her position and body posture were as authoritative as ever. She was leading her family along a narrow trail bordered by acacia and cabbage trees, reveling in the freedom. As much as he loved flying the Cessna, there was something delicious about lacking body and inertia, the ability to traverse the sky like a demon at the merest whim. Geoffrey scouted the other herds, taking the opportunity to refresh his memories of their structures and hierarchies. He also pinpointed the roving bulls, solitary or in small, quarrelsome gangs. The minds of bull elephants, soaked with testosterone, preoccupied with status and mating, felt infinitely more alien to him than those of the matriarchs and their herds. And yet he'd known many of these bulls when they were juvenile males, as boisterous and carefree as the rest. Minds were deeply strange things. When these elephants were young, it had required no great effort to see the sparks of human awareness in their curiosity and playfulness. It was even possible to think that their minds were in fact more human before adulthood clamped down and locked those attributes away, secure behind iron walls of dominance and aggression. Elephant society was a product of necessity, shaped by environmental factors over countless millions of years. But what did that mean, here and now? Things were changing for the elephants, had been changing for centuries. Humans had come, and the humans had done things to the climate that made the world convulse. Steamships to space elevators, all that in a Darwinian eye blink, a strobe flash of massively compressed change. Elephants were still dealing with the fact that monkeys had fire and spears. They hadn't even begun to process the Industrial Revolution, let alone the Space Age or the Anthropocene. Bolder changes were still coming down the line. Changes that even humans would struggle to accommodate. The panspermian initiatives. The green efflorescence. Observing elephants, monitoring them, even creeping into their skulls, that was acceptable to Geoffrey. But making them into something else, rewiring their society as if it was no more than a defective mechanism, transforming it into something better equipped to survive. He wasn't sure how he felt about that. People had done enough harm, even with the best of intentions. When he chinged back into his body, someone was waiting for permission to manifest. The tag was unfamiliar, so for a moment he presumed it was Sunday, coming in via an unorthodox, highly quangled routing. He took the call in the research shack. He had made coffee before chinging, and now, as the figment assumed reality, he drained the bitter dregs into his cup.
"I hope I haven't caught you at an inopportune moment, Mr. Akinya. I did say I'd be back in touch, didn't I?"
Geoffrey studied the blank-eyed man with his sea-green suit and toothless gash of a mouth, his skin so pale that it might have been grafted from a reptile's belly. "Kind of hoping you might have forgotten, Truro."
"Well, I can't fault your honesty. But no, we don't forget our debts. Especially when they've been extended, remortgaged."
"If Sunday cut a deal with you, that's between you and her."
"Ah, but it doesn't work like that, if it ever did. We've done you two favors now, Mr. Akinya. I'd very much like us at least to begin to discuss something by way of reciprocity."
"You can start by telling me where you're chinging from."
"Oh, not so very far from you. Your sister correctly deduced that I was based on or near Earth. As it happens, I'm practically within spitting distance. I'm calling from Tiamat, not too far from your Somalian coast. You'll have heard of it, of course.
I'm not an idiot. Why have you waited until now to contact me?
You needed time to reflect, to assess your obligations to family. Sunday has arrived at her destination. We facilitated her visit, and the quangled bind from Phobos. She is awake. History has begun again. It felt like an appropriate time to resume negotiations.
Geoffrey knew that Sunday was safe. He had received her message and made a point of blinking her a view of Kilimanjaro by way of reply. I'm not sure anything needs negotiating.
Chama Akbulut found something, didn't he? On the moon, in the Chinese sector.
Geoffrey picked a fly out of the coffee's cold meniscus. If you say so.
I confess there are two reasons why we ought to meet in person, and with some urgency. One is the business with Chama, Gleb, and the Phyletic Dwarves. It's a marvelous little project, and it has my absolute support. There's something else, though. You've come to the attention of... Well, I shan't say for the moment, but a colleague of mine has requested an audience.
Thing is, my calendar's a little full.
And this is science, Mr. Akinia. Whatever your plans, I doubt there's anything so pressing that it can't wait a few days.
Geoffrey opened his mouth to argue, but beyond the usual vague notions of getting ahead on paperwork, he had no detailed intentions. You're not going away, are you?
As you'll find, I'm a remarkably persistent soul.
You're going to keep bothering me. I suppose I might as well get it over with.
Splendid,
Truro said, as if he had been expecting no other response.
You shall come to Tiamat, and the pleasure will be all mine. I have your Qing coordinates. Shall we say, this location tomorrow morning? 10 a.m.? Very good.
The knob clicked, the door emitting a mouse-like squeak of protestation as it opened. Eunice's room was cool, the windows permanently shuttered. A ceiling fan stirred the air to no detectable benefit. Geoffrey had peered into this room at various points during his childhood and adolescence, but not often since his late teens. Eunice's figment had sometimes manifested here, but as often as not, it had appeared somewhere else in the household or its grounds. Whatever the case, Geoffrey had usually done his best to be elsewhere. The room was a time capsule, a piece of the 21st century lodged in the present. The rose-printed wallpaper was paper, not active material. It was pasted onto the walls and couldn't be altered at a moment's whim. Rectangular fade marks hinted at the locations of old pictures, join lines where the sheets didn't quite match, and little white lesions where the paper had been scuffed. The rug on the floor was a kind of textile rather than a self-cleansing front carpet. When he stood on it, it didn't ooze over his shoes and try to pick them clean of nourishment. The furniture was wooden, not the kind of wood that grew purposefully into furniture shapes, but the kind that started off as trees before being hacked and rolled and sawed and steamed into shape. There were things in this room older than the Cessna. One wall wasn't papered, or had been papered and then painted over. The mural didn't fill the entire area. It was bordered in white and smaller than Geoffrey remembered. The wall faced east, towards the real Kilimanjaro.
I was right, Eunice said. You can blink it for Sunday's sake, but I've seen it through your eyes now, and that's much the same thing.
I haven't seen the other one. What's different?
Directly below the mountain here. She was pointing at a long-legged bird, maybe a crane or an ibis. The etymology of Kilimanjaro isn't very clear, but it may mean white mountain or white hill. This bird is white. Do you see?
I do.
In the version on Phobos, it's a different bird. I saw it immediately, but I had to be sure. Sunday would never have realized, but...
Get to it, Eunice. His nerves were addled after the visitation from Truro. Some of us have lives to be getting on with.
It's a peacock, she said, painted in exactly the same position. That's the only point of difference between the two murals. We have stills of the Indian camp taken around 2062, and some of them show the mural. There was no difference between this one and that one at that point. So I must have made the change when I returned to Phobos in 2099.
Fine, and this is supposed to mean something to me?
From White Mountain to Peacock Mountain. Geoffrey, must I labor the point? The original mural refers to Kilimanjaro. The one on Phobos can only refer to Pavonis Mons.
Pavonis Mons, he repeated.
On Mars, it's the
highest mountain or volcano or something.
That's Olympus Mons, but you're on the right lines. Pavonis Mons is still pretty impressive. Main thing is I was there. If there was no documented link to my past, then you'd be forgiven for dismissing the mural. But I was there. I walked on that mountain. It was 2081. I was 51 years old. Pregnant with Miriam. We know the exact coordinates.
Then all Sunday has to do is... Geoffrey trailed off. She mentioned complications, Eunice.
The figment swallowed audibly. There are... difficulties.
Such as...
That part of Mars, the Tharsis Bulge, it's changed a little since my time.
Memphis motioned Geoffrey to take a seat until his call was done. Geoffrey poured himself some water from the jug set on a low table near Memphis's desk.
What can I do for you, Geoffrey?
Memphis asked pleasantly when he had come out of Ching.
I have to go away, just for a couple of days, leaving tomorrow morning. Could you check on things while I'm gone?
It is rather short notice.
I know, but I'd feel a lot happier if you could do that for me.
Memphis shook his head, a gesture of good-natured exasperation that Geoffrey remembered well from his earliest days.
What are we going to do with you, young man? Couple of days, you said.
That's all. And you don't need to spend hours out there.
Could you not ching from wherever you'll be?
That may not be possible. Anyway, I'd rather someone went there in person.
Yes. Memphis said in long-suffering tones. One does. Well, you would not ask this lightly, I think. I will inspect Matilda's herd from an airport. Will that suffice?
If you could also land and inspect the perimeter monitors and then check on the camp, that would be even better.
Will one inspection per day suffice?
Geoffrey shifted in his seat.
If that's all you can give me.
Which is your way of saying you would rather I made at least two.
Geoffrey smiled softly.
Thank you, Memphis.
This mysterious trip of yours. You'll be sure to tell me what it's all about when you get back.
I will, I promise. I don't want there to be any secrets between us.
Nor I.
There was a lull. Memphis looked ready to return to his work, so Geoffrey made to stand up. But his old mentor was not quite done.
Now that Eunice is never coming back, we should give some thought to what happens to her room. She would not have wanted it kept as some miserable dusty shrine.
There are plenty of rooms in the household going spare.
When we have many guests, as we did during the scattering, we are considerably stretched. If the subject upsets you, I won't raise it again. But I know your cousins will be anxious to move on.
Bury the past, you mean?
We must all do that if we are to keep living,
Memphis said.
In the morning, Geoffrey saw a glint of moving silver,
an aircraft with an upright tail fin sharking low over the trees. Gradually, he heard the drone of... He shook his head, ready to laugh at the patent absurdity of it. The only thing in his experience that made a sound anything like that was the Cessna, and the Cessna was sitting in plain view.
Eunice, he said quietly, I could use some help here.
She was with him in an instant, as if she had never been more than a few paces away.
What is it, Geoffrey?
Need a reality check. Tell me I'm not looking at an aeroplane even older than my own.
Geoffrey was shielding his eyes from the sun. Eunice echoed his gesture, but at the same time, from where he hadn't noticed, produced a pair of slim grasshopper-green binoculars, which she held to her eyes, single-handed, as daintily as if they were opera glasses. She tracked the moving form of the aircraft, now almost nose on.
If I'm not very much mistaken, that is a DC-3. Is there any particular reason why a DC-3 would be coming down to land, miles from anywhere, in the middle of Equatorial East Africa?
It's my ride, Geoffrey said.
Eunice lowered the binoculars.
To where?
Somewhere interesting, I hope. The DC-3 dropped under the tree line, its engines throttling back. They walked over to meet it.
They were extraordinarily numerous and long-lived, Eunice said, as they picked their way through dry brush. 16,000, and that's not including all the copies and knockoffs. Even when they were old, you could strip out the avionics, put in new engines, and begin again, with zero fatigue rating. Dakotas were still flying when I was a child.
Did you like planes?
Adored them.
Eunice was stomping her merry way through the thigh-high grass as if it wasn't there at all.
Look at it this way. You've been born in a time when it's possible to fly through the air in machines. Who wouldn't fall in love with the idea of that?
The DC-3 sat tail down at the end of the airstrip. It was quite astonishingly beautiful. A gorgeous, sleek thing, as curvaceous and purposeful as a dolphin. But incongruously, there was no sign of a welcoming committee. A door had been opened and a set of steps lowered, but no one was standing at the top of those steps, beckoning him aboard.
Are you sure this is for you?
I thought so, he said, but with ebbing confidence.
Yet what else could it be but the transport Truro had promised? Then he saw a neat little logo on the tail fin, a spiral galaxy painted green, the only marking anywhere on the highly reflective silver fuselage. If that didn't clinch it, nothing would. They climbed aboard. It was cool inside, with seats and settees laid out in lounge fashion, and a bar situated at the rear of the fuselage. The compartment ran all the way to the nose. There was no cockpit, no flight controls or instrument panel, merely a couple of additional lounge seats for those who wanted to take advantage of the forward view. Behind them, the steps folded back into the plane and the door sealed itself. The engines revved up again, and Geoffrey felt the aircraft turning on the airstrip.
And you've no idea what this is about?
You, ultimately, Geoffrey said. Soon they were bouncing along the airstrip and then aloft, climbing shallowly, skimming the treetops by no more than hand-widths.
Well, this is grand fun, Eunice said, striding imperiously from window to window. I'm still here, too. Whoever sent this thing is allowing you full access to the org. That's reassuring, isn't it? You're not being kidnapped.
I never thought I was.
Eunice soon tired of the view and sat herself down in one of the seats.
So, who sent this aircraft?
The Panspermian Initiative. You know about them. You used to hang out with Lin Wei.
I don't know anyone called Lin Wei.
You should do. But there's a part of your life missing.
Sunday established the connection with Lin, but she doesn't have enough information to fill in the rest of the void.
Have to take your word for it, then. So we're going to see this Lin Wei?
I doubt it, seeing as she's dead. My point of contact is someone called Truro.
Whom you trust enough to get aboard this plane?
I'm in his debt. Actually, we're all in his debt, but I'm the one who seems to be expected to do the paying back.
The Panspermian Initiative, Eunice said languidly, drawing out the words as if she was reading them, sign-written across the sky.
She was tapping the org, glugging gallons of data.
You need to watch people like that. All that species imperative stuff, self-aggrandizing horse piss.
They think we might be in a critical period, a window of opportunity. If we don't seize the moment now, we might never get beyond the system, into the wider galaxy.
Which would automatically be a good thing, would it?
You weren't exactly short of grand visions in your day, she scoffed.
I didn't have any noble intentions for the rest of humanity. I was in it for myself, and anyone else smart enough to go along with me.
No, Geoffrey said, shaking his head. You were a pioneer and a risk-taker, sure, but you also had ambitions. You didn't go to Mars just to stamp your footprint in the soil and come home again. You wanted to live there, to prove it was something we could do.
Me and 1,000 others, doesn't matter.
You got there as soon as you could, but your problem was that you couldn't stand still. You had to keep moving, pushing outwards. You liked the idea of living on one planet more than the actuality. That's why you left your husband behind.
Jonathan and I grew apart. What's that got to do with anything?
If you were alive now, with enough influence to be part of this, you'd be one of the main drivers.
Spoken with the assurance of youth. Well, I'm sorry to prick your bubble, but did you ever wonder why I came back to the Winter Palace? Everything Eunice Akinya used to stand for started to bore me senseless.
So you decided to become a witchy old recluse, counting her money and tut-tutting at her offspring.
Since you put it so charmingly, yes.
They had been traveling for 2 hours straight before they left Africa behind, crossing the buttressed white margin of the self-renewing seawall and into the airspace above the Indian Ocean. There were boats at sea, fishing and leisure craft, even some of the elegant multi-masted cyber clippers, benign Marie Celestes, holds abrim with bulky non-perishable cargoes. To the south, the edge of one of the floating platelets, an artificial island capped by its own fevered little weather system. Another island, smaller this time, or a dense thicket of skyscrapers, as if Singapore had become unmoored and drifted halfway around the world. As the DC-3 approached, the city revealed itself to be a congregation of stack farms, rising 2 kilometers from sea level. The stacks were mossy with vegetation, green carpeted up their sheer flanks. Robot dirigibles harvested the tops of the stacks, crowding around them like fattened bumblebees as they waited their turn. Aside from a skeleton staff of technicians, no one would live on that island. The DC-3 kept flying. Geoffrey checked his watch. It was 2 in the afternoon. They'd been in the air for 4 hours. He hadn't expected the journey to take this long. Just when he was starting to worry that the plane was going to carry him all the way to India, however many hours that might entail, something loomed from the ocean haze. Whatever it was, rose straight from the sea, a solid-looking mass with a rounded, symmetrical summit. It was a structure, a very large one, with the open maw of a snorkel facing him. The DC-3 was headed straight for it. Geoffrey knew better than to be alarmed. If the Pans were going to kill him, there were simpler ways of going about it than a plane crash. The engine note changed, the floor tilting as the aircraft lost altitude. Do you know what that is?
An aqualogy transit duct, Eunice said. They're built up from the seabed, raised on stilts of artificial coral, grown and replenished like the self-renewing sea walls.
He'd moved to the forward seats for the best view. A pale, bat-like craft emerged from the snorkel and sped south. One of the harvester dirigibles loitered near the entrance, awaiting clearance to proceed. Rafts of green biomass drooled from its collector basket. The DC-3 had approach priority. The descent steepened, and then they were inside the snorkel, flying down a completely enclosed air corridor. Geoffrey tried to judge the angle of descent, but without a visible horizon it was hard to estimate. It felt much steeper than his usual landing pattern in the Cessna, but at the same time, there was a sense of calm routine. The ride, elevator smooth. He hadn't even been told to sit down or buckle up. The corridor darkened as the sunlit mouth receded. Red lights slipped by on either side, marking their progress. Once, another Batwing craft sped by in the opposite direction, silver-bodied, with the initiative's green wall painted on its skin. "We've descended a long way," Geoffrey said. "We must be underwater by now."
"They're blocking me."
"What?"
"Org degradation. The duct must be interfering with the signal. I imagine that's not accidental."
"Can't you do anything about it?"
"Dear me, that almost sounds like concern for my welfare."
"It's not. I just value a second pair of eyes." He paused. "Eunice?" His visual field cluttered with error messages. She was gone. His ears popped. The ride leveled out for a stretch, then, softly enough, that he almost thought it might be his imagination, the DC-3 was down. It rolled for a short while as smoothly as if sliding on ice, and then came to a halt. The tunnel had widened out into a larger space, lit by banks of blue lights. The door whirred open, the stairs lowering simultaneously. Geoffrey grabbed his overnight bag and climbed out of the now silent transport. He stepped onto hard black ground, sheened like wet asphalt. The chamber was large enough to hold half a dozen other aircraft, though none were as old as the DC-3. Nearby, a harvester was having its collector baskets raked clean. Without Eunice and without the Org, Geoffrey felt more vulnerable than he'd been expecting. He didn't want to think about all the megatons of seawater somewhere over his head, especially as some of it appeared to be dripping through the ceiling. "Well, thanks for the welcome," he said quietly. A merwoman strode out of the darkness. Her mobility prosthesis encased her body from the ribcage down, gripping corset tight. Mechanical legs emerged from the exo's pelvic girdle, spaced wide on complex joints. They were articulated backwards, giving the merwoman the look of some giant strutting bird. The exo whirred and clanked, as if it wasn't in the best repair. The framework was bottle green, traced with luminous kelp-like patterns. In impeccable Swahili, she said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Akinya. I hope your journey was a pleasant one." "Whose idea was the Dakota?" "Truro thought you'd appreciate the antique touch. Rest assured, though, that you'll be going home by conventional means. I am Mira Gilbert, UAN Office of Scientific and Technological Liaison. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Tiamat. I trust the absence of Org isn't too distressing."
"I'm coping."
"We have our own local Org here, and something very like the mechanism. You'll be given access to the baseline functions, but before that, I'm afraid we'll need to neutralize any recording devices that you might be carrying."
"I'm not."
"That also includes your eyes, Mr. Akinya. Their capture and record function must be disabled."
Her tone was apologetic but insistent.
"I trust this isn't too great an inconvenience. Any information already on the eyes should be safe."
Geoffrey bristled, but he'd come too far to throw a tantrum now. "If that's what it takes.
Please follow me."
She whirred around in the exo and clanked away, leading Geoffrey through a door in the side of the cavern and along a dank, wet-floored corridor. "You speak Swahili very well," he told her.
"Helps in this region. I understand you've been in space recently."
"The moon and back, assuming that counts. Do you leave Tiamat very often?"
"I don't leave water very often, let alone the city. Frankly, I can't wait to get out of this clanking contraption. It's not that I minded meeting you, though."
After a few paces, she added,
"I have been to space, though. I was a pilot before I was seconded to Tiamat."
"How long have you been..." He felt tongue-tied.
"Aquatic. 13 years now. Takes a little while to get used to the alterations. The brain has to learn a whole new way of moving, a whole new hydrodynamics."
The first 6 months were difficult. After that, I never looked back.
And could you be reversed if you wanted to?
Perhaps, Gilbert said, managing to sound as if the notion had never really occurred to her. Some have defected back to Lubber, but they must have been formed for the wrong reasons.
She turned to look back over her shoulder.
People think becoming like this is the magic spell that'll sort out their lives, put an end to all their worldly woes. Nowadays, the psych screening's much more rigorous. There's also a huge waiting list for new surgery. You can't just wake up one morning and decide to become aquatic.
You're not worried about overcrowding, surely?
Not really. There's more surface area down here than on all the dry land masses combined. Earth coexists with a planet as large as Mars, and all you have to do to cross from one to the other is swim. But there are bottlenecks. Our clinics can only cope with so many transformations, and with the germline programs making ever more headway, there'll soon be second-generation aquatics who never came through the clinics. Mer-children, born of mer-people. Then we'll have to impose much stricter quotas. Needless to say, our offspring will have priority. It's not too late to join us, though.
Become a citizen. Thanks, but I've got other plans for the rest of my life. They rode an elevator up shaft and emerged into a clean white-tiled room, with the tiled floor eventually giving way to a shimmering rectangle of turquoise water accessed at various points by stairs and ramps. It resembled a large indoor swimming pool. Dim, greenish light filtered through heavy strutted ceiling windows. That must be the ocean above his head, he thought. Enough of it that the full glare of sunlight was reduced to this soupy, olive-stained radiance. You can locomote the rest of the way if you want to, Gilbert said. But it would really make a lot more sense if you travelled by water instead. Do you swim?
Geoffrey couldn't recall the last time he'd set foot in water.
A bit. The merwoman gestured to a white door in the tiled wall to Geoffrey's right.
Wetsuit in there. Leave your clothes and belongings in there. They'll be forwarded to your quarters later.
With some diffidence, Geoffrey locked himself in the changing room and removed his clothes. He bundled them up in a wire-frame basket, then examined the waiting wetsuit. It was fixed against the wall by some hidden means, legs and arms spread wide. It was a vivid yellow-green colour, with a texture like fine-grained sandpaper. He was just starting to work out the best way to get into it when the suit peeled open along hidden seams, exactly as if a kindly poltergeist were offering assistance. Geoffrey turned and shuffled backwards, arms and legs mirroring the suit's posture, and waited for the fabric to seal itself around his body. At first, it tightened alarmingly, sucking onto his skin as if vacuum formed. Rather to his surprise, he found that he could still breathe without difficulty. He felt, in fact, completely unclothed, and when he brushed his bare fingertips across his fabric-clad chest, it felt as if he was touching his own skin. High-res tactile transmission system, he supposed. The kind they had in spacesuits these days. He walked out of the room, feeling more self-conscious than he would have liked. The suit enclosed him from ankle to neck, but its tight-fitting contours were barely sufficient to preserve his modesty.
Good, Gilbert said, giving him no more than a momentary glance. Now for the aquamobility harness.
She walked him over to the far wall, where a dozen or so sleek white devices were racked in a line. They resembled the partial skeletons of marine mammals, each with a segmented spine, a fluke, articulated side flippers, a lacy suggestion of a skull. There was also a kind of cracked open rib cage.
I meant to get into that.
You want to keep up with me, Gilbert said. You'd better. Back into the harness. It'll do the rest.
Geoffrey did as he was told, selecting the first of the harnesses. The rib cage pincered slowly around him, clutching his chest firmly, the padded insides of the ribs reshaping to provide maximum surface area contact. The skull enclosed his head, forming an openwork cage equipped with a breathing apparatus and suction goggles. He felt the harness detached from the wall mounting, so that he was bearing what little weight it possessed. It felt as flimsy as a cheaply made carnival costume.
What do I do with it? Geoffrey asked, feeling awkward. He could speak and see freely. The breathing apparatus was still hinged away from his mouth and nose, and the goggles had yet to clamp onto his eye sockets. Step into the water. The harness will sense your intentions and operate accordingly. With this, Gilbert divested herself of the exo. She slipped out of it and slid into the water, sleek as an otter. Released from the exo, she was effectively naked, but her form was so thoroughly alien that Geoffrey might as well have been watching a wildlife documentary. He took one of the sloping ramps and walked into the blood-warm water. When he was up to his waist, the harness latched onto his legs and coaxed them gently together. Without any apparent conscious volition on his part, the harness then pushed him into a horizontal swimming posture. Before he had a chance to gag on the water, the mask and goggles had covered his face. The view through the goggles was as bright and clear as day, lacking any optical distortion or cloudiness. "Follow me," Gilbert said, and he heard her clearly through the water. She flexed her body and torpedoed past him, executing an exuberant barrel roll. He kicked his legs and paddled his arms. Miraculously, he surged forwards, the harness flexing all the way along its spine, taking his legs with it. The feeble paddling of his arms was amplified a dozen or a hundredfold by the elegant, widespread flippers which extended a good 2 meters either side of him. Gilbert was still ahead, swimming underwater, at least as fast as someone might jog on dry land. But Geoffrey was only a body length or so behind her. For all the power she put into her swimming, it was evidently a very efficient process, judging by the lack of turbulence in her wake. "Not claustrophobic, are you?" she asked. "If I was, now would be a bit late to find out." "We'll take the express tube. You'll like this." Around the pool's submerged walls were several tunnel mouths, each ringed by a hoop of glowing primary colour. "Red are the exit tubes. We don't take those," Gilbert said. "Wouldn't be able to swim against the upcurrent anyway, even with power assist." She aimed for the tunnel mouth ringed in glowing purple, appearing to accelerate into the moor at the last moment. Geoffrey followed, muscularly signalling his intention to steer and feeling the harness respond almost instantly. Indeed, it appeared to be adapting to him as quickly as he was adapting to it. He was swimming underwater as effortlessly as a dolphin. He grinned. It would be madness not to enjoy this. He felt the surge as the tunnel's current seized him, and then he was racing along it, glassy walls speeding by, Gilbert not far ahead. As the tube twisted and turned, the water inside it flowing up and down, he wondered what drove that flow. He couldn't see any visible fans or pumps, unless they retracted out of the way as the swimmers passed. Perhaps it was peristalsis, a gentle but continuous impulsion driven by the walls themselves. He had no sooner formulated that idea than they were startlingly outside, crossing between one part of Tiamat and another, with only the tube's glass between them and the crush of the surrounding water. They were crossing through a forest of night-lit towers, turreted and flanged and cupolaed, submarine skyscrapers pushing up from black depths, garlanded with myriad-coloured lights. The buildings were cross-linked and buttressed by huge windowed arches, many stories high, and the whole city district, as far as he could see, lay entwined in a bird's nest tangle of water-filled tubes. He could, in fact, make out one or two tiny moving forms, far above and far below, swimmers carrying their own illumination, so that they became glowing corpuscles in some godlike arterial system. Elsewhere, there were ocean-swimming aquatics moving outside of the tubes, and all manner of submersible vehicles ranging from person-sized miniature submarines to servicing craft at least as large as one of the cyber clippers he had seen from the air. Geoffrey reeled. He knew about Tiamat. He knew about the United Aquatic Nations and had some idea of what they were getting up to under the waves, but the scale of the thing was startling. He realized that he had been operating under a gross misapprehension. Living on dry land, it was easy to think that the aquatics constituted no more than a faltering experiment in undersea living, like an early moon base. But this was a kingdom. For a moment, dizzied, he began to wonder if it was his existence that was the failed experiment. As quickly as it had been disclosed, the view of Tiamat was snatched away, and he was back inside, the tube hairpinning again, ducking and diving with joyous abandon through a series of vertical S-bends until it deposited the two of them in another swimming pool, or rather what he now appreciated to be a kind of interchange between the various tube systems, with its own color-coded portals. It was a bigger junction, and they were not alone this time. Other aquatics loitered in the pool, not too close to the entrance exit points with their strong currents. There were even some visitors or newcomers, wearing harnesses like his own. They were gathered into groups, talking and laughing. Some were fully aquaformed, like Gilbert, but there were others who still retained basic lubber anatomy, with a normal complement of limbs. Some of these borderline cases appeared happy with prolonged submersion, while others wore lightweight breathing devices of various kinds. From what Jeffrey had gathered, the process of full aqua transformation wasn't an overnight thing. There were many way stations along the route, and not everyone opted to proceed with further surgery once they'd received the basic modifications. Gilbert swam to an orange portal, and then they were rushing down another tube, not as far this time, until they came out into another junction, this one not much larger than the first. This pool had its share of portals, but there were also color-coded exits that were not yet open to the water. Gilbert swam to one of these exits and pressed a webbed hand into the panel to its right. The circular door rolled aside, revealing an illuminated, water-filled corridor. After a short distance, they emerged into a pool that was scarcely larger than a private jacuzzi. It occupied a curving, green-walled room with windows set into one side. Jeffrey made to stand up, pushing his head into the open air, the mask and goggles unclasping automatically with a soft pop of released suction. Water stampeded off him in 1,000 beetle-sized droplets. Through the windows in one half of the room, he saw another aspect of Tiamat's abundant underwater sprawl. Towers, a fungal growth of geodesic domes, glowing from within with floodlit greenery. Tiamat went on for kilometers. A kind of channel or ditch ran away from the jacuzzi through an arch into an adjoining room. Gilbert swam ahead, but with her face and upper body mostly out of the water. Jeffrey, now upright, shuffled behind. The harness retracted its flippers, tucking them away like folded angel's wings. He'd only been aquatic for a few minutes, and already walking felt like an absurd evolutionary dead end. The water-filled ditch led them into Truro's presence.
"So very glad you accepted my invitation," he said grandly. "You were, of course, never under any binding obligation to deal with us again."
"That's not how it felt," Jeffrey said.
"Well, let's look on the positive side. You're here now, and we have every likelihood of finding common ground."
Truro had changed. He wasn't the man in the sea-green suit anymore. Now he floated in a green-tiled, kidney-shaped pool, bubbling with scented froth. His head merged seamlessly with the smooth ovoid of his torso. All details of his underlying skeleton and musculature rendered cryptic beneath layers of insulating blubber. His grey skin, which was completely hairless, shone with a waxy pearlescence. He had no external ears and scarcely any nose. His nostrils were two muscle-activated slits that opened and closed with each breath. He had large, almost round eyes, very dark and penetrating. They blinked a complicated double-membrane blink. "Why didn't your figment look like this?"
"It would only have complicated the issue further, I think. Besides, when I manifest, I tend to revert to my former anatomy. Call it a nostalgic attachment."
Truro touched a web-fingered hand against the area where, prior to his surgery, his nose must have been.
"Not that I have any regrets. But sometimes, you know, for old time's sake.
Consoles and data displays with chunky waterproof keypads bobbed in the water like brightly coloured bath toys. Geoffrey couldn't remember the last time he'd seen actual, solid data visualization and interface systems outside of a museum. Books were more common than screens and keypads. Truro barged the yoke of a keypad aside, clearing room in front of him.
Come in. Join me, he said, ushering them forward. We've much to talk about.
May I leave you now, sir? Asked Gilbert.
Of course. Thank you, Mira.
When they were alone, Geoffrey divested himself of the mobility harness, leaving it propped against a wall while he returned to the pool. He eased into the turbulent, fizzing waters, sitting cross-legged opposite the merman.
So, what do you think of the old place?
Truro asked, leaning back with his muscular arms resting along the pool's tiled edge, webbed fingers trailing in the water. The tiny part of it I've seen is impressive enough.
It's a wonderful life down here. We're aquatic apes at heart. Returning to the seas is only the expression of something deep within us. A calling, if you will. And each year more people respond to that call.
I thought you Pans wanted a migration outwards, not back into the oceans.
Many paths to the one goal. We can return to the seas and take the seas with us to the stars.
Truro smiled quickly as if his own words had betrayed him.
Sometimes rhetoric gets the better of me. Please don't take anything I say too seriously. That wouldn't do at all.
I'm happy on dry land. Thanks. Geoffrey paused, sensing that the quickest way to get this over and done with was to go straight to the point. Can we talk about the Phyletic Dwarves, since that's obviously why I'm here? Truro's unusual countenance evinced pain at this abrupt curtailment of preliminaries.
That's part of it, certainly. Matter of fact, I've Charmer on hold right now. Said I'd let him know when you got in.
I didn't think Charmer was meant to have any contact with the world beyond the descrutinized zone.
And what are private quangle paths for, if not for circumventing such tedious legal constraints?
Truro reached for the floating keypad and depressed one of the spongy controls.
Charmer, you can manifest now. Geoffrey Akinya is here.
Turning to Geoffrey, he added,
I'm giving you local org access. Excuse me while I make my own arrangements.
The merman fumbled in the water for a pair of lurid yellow goggles, which he slipped over his dark, seal-like eyes with elastic straps. You don't have retinal implants, Geoffrey said, startled.
Removed at the time of my aquaforming. Does that appall you?
Truro looked to his left, towards an area of tiled floor where Charmer's figment was now standing.
Ah, he said, beaming magnanimously. Good to see you.
Charmer looked at Geoffrey.
How are the elephants?
They're doing fine. They barely noticed I was gone. Time lag slowed Charmer's response.
Gleb and I've had a lot of time to talk things over, and we're even more convinced that this is the way forward.
Charmer's already filled me in on the background, said Truro. From our standpoint, there are no insurmountable technical challenges. We would need to extend neural intervention to all the elephants in your study group, with the exception of perhaps the very youngest calves, and limit the interaction with non-augmented herd members wherever possible. But from what I gather, as things stand, we can proceed immediately on a trial basis.
Quangle paths are allocated? Charmer asked, as if they were merely fussing over details.
Already in place, the merman said. The anticipated load isn't exorbitant, and we should be able to manage things without drawing undue attention.
There's a lot more to it than that, Geoffrey said, alarmed by how readily his consent was being assumed. The ethical considerations, for a start.
The merman scratched under one of his blubbery, hairless armpits.
My dear fellow, there could hardly be anything more ethical than actively furthering the welfare of a species, surely.
Geoffrey smiled, suddenly grasping his place in things.
This is how you operate, isn't it?
Always going a bit too far, always counting on people falling for your arguments that what's done is done, that the best they can do is cooperate.
Look at it this way, Chalmers said. When it comes to long-term funding, who would you rather do business with, us or your family? We're in it for the seriously long game, and we've every incentive to protect you and the Amboseli herds from outside interference.
You're good at this, Geoffrey said.
We have to be, Truro said. It's how things get done.
We can begin almost immediately, Chalmers said briskly. Starting with some simple test figments, dropping ghost images of other elephants into their visual fields, distant enough that olfactory and auditory hallucinations won't be required. We'll run exactly the same assessment protocols on the lunar dwarves.
You just have to give us the chink codes, Truro said. Then we can really start to make things happen.
Collaborate with us, Chalmers said pleadingly. Do something bigger than your family. Something that'll still have meaning centuries from now.
Join the Pans, Geoffrey said, his own voice sounding hollow and drained of fight.
Become a fellow traveler, that's all. No one's asking you to swallow the ideology in its entirety.
Truro is speaking now.
Still, I won't insult you by reminding you that there's a debt to be paid for what Charma did for you on the moon. It was all to do with your grandmother, wasn't it?
Geoffrey saw no purpose in lies or evasion. I'm sure Chalmers told you enough.
The basics. Just when we thought we had Eunice Akenya pinned down, she surprises us all. She was close to us once, did you know?
I've heard about her Pan involvement.
That business on Mercury. Such a tragedy it ended the way it did. There's so much we could have done together. But Eunice had to go and betray Lin.
Geoffrey saw his moment. Did you know Lin Wei? My sister was hoping to find out what really went on there.
No, I never had the pleasure of meeting the first Prime Pan. Lin Wei drowned, of course. They told you that?
Yes, Geoffrey said.
Arethusa knew her very well indeed. When the current Prime Pan learned of your interest, you became of, shall we say, reciprocal interest to Arethusa.
Truro appeared to be having difficulty finding the appropriate words.
No disrespect to Charma or the elephants, but that's really why you're here. Arethusa demands an audience.
Since I've already been dragged here, Geoffrey said, I may as well speak to anyone who wants a conversation. Will the Prime Pan be coming here? Truro's minimalist features nonetheless evinced apology.
The mountain must go to Mohammed, I'm afraid. Are you up for a bit more swimming?